shall you suffer while the special few are rewarded? Director Pravat called out to the crowd. They answered with a collective no. Shall you be worked to death while the chosen ones from Dahara only grow richer? Again the crowd shouted no. Shall we let our good works of helping all Hakans rise above their nature be cast aside by this one man? Shall we allow our people to again be led astray by the cruel deception of education? The crowd shouted their agreement with Director Pravat, some waving their hats, as Dalton had instructed them to do. There were perhaps 50 of his Haken messengers in the crowd, dressed in their old clothes, doing their best to pump emotion into the responses to Director Pravat's speech. There were people caught up in the passion of the words, no doubt, but for the most part, the crowd silently watched, judging if their own lives would be altered by what they heard. Most people weighed matters on a scale, with their life on one side and the events before them on the other side. Most people were satisfied with the way things were, so only if the events on the other side of the scale threatened to outweigh or change their lives did they become concerned. Dalton was not pleased. These people, while agreeing, did not see the events on the other side of the scales as much affecting their life. Dalton knew they had a problem. The message was getting out, but it was falling on little more than indifferent ears. "He is making a lot of good points," Teresa said. Dalton hugged her shoulders. "Yes, he is. I think the man is right. The poor Hakans will only be hurt if we don't continue to see to their well-being. They aren't prepared to handle the cruelty of life on their own." Dalton's gaze moved among the people standing like statues as they watched the director pour out his passion. "Yes, darling, you're right. We must do more to help the people." Dalton realized then what was missing and what he must do. Chapter 56. "No," Richard said to Dushaloo. She folded her arms in smoldering anger. The way her big round belly stuck out made her pose look almost humorous. Richard leaned toward her and lowered his voice. "Dushaloo, can't you understand? I would like to be alone with Kaelin for just a little while. Please?" Dushaloo's anger faltered. Her frown melted. "Oh, I see. You want to be intimate with your other wife. This is good. It has been a long time." "That's not..." Richard put his fists on his hips. "And just how would you know, anyway?" She didn't answer his question, but smiled. "Well, all right, then. If you promise not to take too long." He wanted to say it would take as long as it took, but he feared what her answer might be. Richard straightened and said simply, "We promise." Captain Meifert, a big, blond-headed Dharan officer in charge of the troops sent to escort Richard and Kaelin to Andorith, didn't like the idea of them being alone any more than did Dushaloo, but he was more circumspect in expressing his objections. General Rybish had apparently told the man he could speak his mind to the Lord Rawl if it were an important matter without fear of punishment. "Lord Rawl, he would be too far away to respond should you need us. To help protect the Mother Confessor," he added as an afterthought, thinking it might sway Richard's decision. "Thank you, Captain. There is only this one trail up there. Since no one knew where we were headed, no one could be laying in wait. It isn't far, and we won't be gone long. You and your men will patrol down here while Kaelin and I go have a look." "Yes, sir," Captain Meifert said in resignation. He immediately began issuing orders to his men, spreading them out at stations and sending some on scout. Richard turned to the two messengers who had come from General Rybish. "Tell the general I'm pleased with the speed he's making, and I'm pleased to know he believes he can make it before Jagang's forces arrive. Tell him the same orders he already has are still in effect. I want him to stand off." Nearly every day messengers came and went, entering past different Domini Dirch at the border so as to be less noticed. Richard had given General Rybish orders to stay well to the north, well beyond Jagang's screen of scouts, sentries, and spies. If it came to a fight, surprise was one of the most valuable elements the Dharan army could possess. The general agreed with that much of it, but was loath to leave Richard with only 1,000 men in potentially hostile territory. Richard had explained in the letters he'd written the man that while he understood the general's concern, they needed to keep his force hidden until and unless they were called. Richard had explained in gruesome detail the horrific and futile death awaiting them at the border if the army tried to breach the Domini Dirch. Until they won the agreement of the Andorith people, they dared not approach their border in force. Moreover, Richard didn't trust Minister Chanbur. The man's tongue was too smooth. Truth didn't wear a tongue smooth. Lies did. The Domnidirch were a spider's web waiting to claim the careless. The look of easy conquest could be a trap to lure the Dharan force to their death. More than anything, Richard feared all those brave young men being slaughtered before the Domnidirch, especially when he knew such sacrifice could accomplish nothing. They would die and the Domnidirch would still stand untouched. General Rybish had written back, promising Richard that once they were in place to the north, they would charge south without pause should Richard call upon them, but he promised to stay put until called.
"Yes, Lord Rawl," the tall messenger said as he clapped a fist to his heart. "I will tell the general your words."
They both wheeled their horses and trotted off down the road. Richard checked that his bow and quiver were secure before he climbed into his saddle. Kaelin flashed him her special smile as they turned their horses up the trail. She, too, Richard knew, was relieved to be alone at last, if for only a brief ride up a side trail. It was wearing to have people constantly around them. When they held hands, eyes took it in. If they did so in front of people while speaking to them, Richard could tell by the looks that it was news that would visit a thousand ears before a few days passed. He knew by the unblinking stares that it would be spoken of for years to come. At least it was a favorable thing for people to gossip about. Better they should talk about the married Lord Rawl and Mother Confessor holding hands than something awful. Richard watched Kaelin sway in the saddle, spellbound by the taper of her body down to her waist, the flare of her hip. He thought she had just about the most alluring shape he had ever seen. He sometimes found it remarkable to think a woman like that would love him, a man who had grown up in a little place in Heartland. Richard missed his home. He guessed those feelings had surfaced because the forest trail up the mountain reminded him so much of places he knew. There were hills and mountains to the west of where he grew up, remote places, that were much like the forests and mountains in which they found themselves. He wished they could return to visit his home in Heartland. He had seen remarkable things since leaving the autumn before, but he guessed none held your heart like the place you grew up. When the trail passed near a steep decline affording a view, Richard looked off to the northwest through gaps in the peaks. They were probably closer to where he had grown up than they had been since he left. They had come across those same mountains into the Midlands, through the boundary, while it had still been up, at a place called Kingsport. It wasn't very far to the northwest. Despite how close it might be, because of the weight of his responsibilities, home in Heartland was now a very distant place. Besides the responsibility of being Lord Rawl and having everyone depending on him, there was Jigang, who, given half a chance, would enslave the new world as he had the old. People depended on Richard for everything from the bond that protected them from the Dreamwalker to pulling everyone together into one force to stand against Jigang's huge armies. Sometimes, when he thought about it, it seemed he was living someone else's life. Sometimes he felt like a fraud, and people were one day going to wake up and say, "Now, wait a minute, this Lord Rawl fellow is just a woods guide named Richard. And we're listening to him? We're following him into war?" And then there were the chimes. Richard and Kaelin were inextricably involved with the chimes. They were responsible for the chimes being in the world of life. Even though it was unintentional, they brought the chimes of death forth. In their traveling around Andorith to talk to people, they had heard stories of the strange death. The chimes were greatly enjoying their visit to the world of life. They were having a marvelous time killing people. In response to the danger, people had fallen back to old superstitions. In some places, people gathered together to pay homage to the evil spirits loosed upon the world. Gifts of food and wine were left in clearings in the woods or in a fallow field. Some folks thought mankind had violated moral bounds, had become too corrupt, and the avenging spirits had been sent by the Creator to punish the world. Some people left gifts of stones down the center of roads and piled yet more rocks at crossroads. No one could explain to Richard exactly why, and were annoyed that he would question the old ways. Some put dead flowers out in front of their door at midnight. Good luck charms were in great demand. The chimes killed anyway. The one thing that made the weight of it all tolerable was Kaelin.
she made the effort of the struggle bearable. For her, he would endure anything. Kaelin raised an arm.
Just up there.
Richard dismounted with her. Most of the trees were spruce or pine. Richard cast about until he found a young silver-leafed maple and tied the reins of their horses to a low branch. Tying reins to pine or spruce, or worse, a balsam, resulted often as not in sticky reins. Richard looked up when he heard a snort. Not far off, a horse, its ears perked forward, watched them. Grass hung from each side of its mouth, but it had stopped chewing.
Well, hello, girl, Richard called.
Wary, the horse tossed its head and backed a few steps to add to its distance. When Richard tried to get closer, it backed away more yet, so he halted. A creamy chestnut color, the horse had an odd leggy splotch of black on its rump. When Richard called to it again, trying to coax it closer, it turned and ran.
I wonder what that's about, he said to Kaelin.
Kaelin held out her hand in invitation. Richard took it.
I don't know. Maybe someone's horse has gotten away. Seems to be uninterested in having anything to do with us, though.
I suppose, Richard said as he let her lead him by the hand.
This is the only way in, she told him as they walked along the lake shore, around a small clump of spruce.
The clouds had been building all day, threatening thunderstorms. Now, as they walked out onto a nub of rock sticking up at the end of the flat spit of land, the sun emerged between the towering, billowing clouds. It was a beautiful sight. A shaft of warm sunlight breaking through amber clouds, slanting down between the mountains to touch the still lake. Across the way, water tumbled over a prominence of rock, sending up into the warm air a drifting mist that sparkled in the sunlight above the golden water. Richard took a deep breath, savoring the sweet aroma of woods and lake. It was almost like home.
This is the place, he gestured.
Up there, higher up, is the desolate place where the paca plant grows and the gambit moss lives. These pure waters come from that poisoned area. The air shimmered in the afternoon light.
It's beautiful. I could stay here forever. I almost feel like I should be scouting new trails.
They stood for a while, hand in hand, savoring the view.
Richard, I just wanted to tell you that the last couple of weeks, as we've talked to people, I've really been proud of you. Proud of the way you've shown people hope for the future. Whatever happens, I just want you to know that. But I'm proud of the way you've handled it.
He frowned. You sound like you don't think we'll win. She shrugged.
It doesn't matter. What will be. People don't always do what's right. Sometimes they don't recognize evil. Sometimes people choose evil because it suits them or because they're afraid. Or because they think they will get something for themselves out of it. The most important thing is that we've done our best, and you've shown people the truth. You put their well-being, their safety, before all else. So if we do triumph, it will be for the right reasons. You've given them the chance to prove their heart.
We'll win, Richard gazed out over the still water. People will see the truth in it.
I hope so.
He put his arm around her neck and kissed the top of her head. He sighed with the pleasure of the mountain lake, the quiet.
There are places deep in the mountains to the west of where I grew up that I don't think anyone but me has ever visited.
Places where the water falls from the rocks high overhead, higher than here, and makes rainbows in the afternoon air. And after you swim in the clear pools, you can curl up on the rocks behind the waterfall and watch the world through the falling water. I've often dreamed of taking you there.
Kaelin slipped her arm around his waist. Someday, Richard, we'll visit your special places.
As they stood close, watching the waterfall, Richard was reluctant to break the spell of the dream, especially to talk about their purpose, but at last he did.
So, why is it called the ovens?
Kaelin lifted her chin to point.
Behind the waterfall is a cave that's warm, sometimes hot, I'm told.
I wonder why Joseph Ander mentioned the place. Kaelin rested a hand on his shoulder.
Maybe even Joseph Ander appreciated a beautiful place.
Maybe, he mumbled, as he searched the scene for a sign of why the wizard would have been interested in this spot. Richard didn't think much of Joseph Ander's sensibilities, or that he had a keen appreciation of such natural beauty. While the man spoke at length about the beauty of nature, It was always in regard to the orderly makeup of a society. Richard noted that all the rock of the mountains around them was a peculiar greenish-gray, except the rock of the cliff across the lake, where the waterfall was. That rock was darker. Not a lot, but it was definitely different. It had more gray than green in it, probably because the grain of the granite had black flecks, although from a distance it was hard to tell. Richard raised his arm, pointing across the lake to the wall from which the water cascaded in a majestic downward arc. "Look at that rock and tell me what you think of it." Kaylin, her white Mother Confessor's dress glowing in the sunlight, almost looked like Richard's dream image of a good spirit. She blinked at him. "What do you mean? It's a rock." "I know, but look at it. Tell me what strikes you about it." She looked at the cliff and back at him. "It's a big rock." "No, come on, be serious." Kaylin sighed and studied the cliff for a time. She looked around at the mountains, especially the nearest to the left a little, the one rising up so prominently from the water's edge. "Well," she said at last, "it's darker than the rock of the mountains around here." "Good. What else strikes you about it?" She studied the wall a while longer. "It's an unusual color. I've seen it before." She suddenly looked up at him. "The Dominie Dirch." Richard smiled. "That's what I think, too. The Dominie Dirch have that same shade of color as that rock over there, but none of the mountains around have it." Her face screwed up in an incredulous frown. "Are you saying that the Dominie Dirch were cut from this stone, way up here in the mountains, and hauled all the way down to where they are today?" Richard shrugged. "Could be, I guess, although I don't know much about moving stonework on such a large scale. I studied the Dominie Dirch. They looked to be carved of one piece of rock. They weren't assembled, at least the one we saw." "Then what?" "Joseph Ander was a wizard, and the wizards of his time were able to do things even Zed would find astounding. Perhaps Joseph simply used this rock as a starting place." "What do you mean? How?" "I don't know. I don't know as much about magic as you. Maybe you could tell me. But what if he simply took a small rock from here for each Dominie Dirch, and then when he got to where they are today, made them big?" "Made them big?" Richard opened his hands in a helpless gesture. "I don't know. Used magic to make the rock grow, or even used the structure of the grain in the rock as a sort of guide to reproduce it with additive magic into the Dominie Dirch." "I was thinking you were going to come up with something silly," Kaylin said. "That actually makes sense as far as I know about magic." Richard was relieved not to have embarrassed himself. "I think I'll take a swim over to the cave and see what's there." "Nothing from what I learned. Just a hot cave. It doesn't go in far, maybe 20 feet. "Well, I don't particularly like caves, but I guess it can't hurt to go have a look." Richard pulled off his shirt. He turned to the water. "Aren't you going to take off your pants?" Richard glanced back to see her sly grin. "I thought I'd wash the smell of horse off them." "Oh," Kaylin said in exaggerated disappointment. Smiling, Richard turned back to the water to jump in. Just before he could, a raven came screeching down at him. Richard had to leap back lest the big black bird hit him. Arm extended behind him, Richard backed Kaylin off the rock. The bird cawed. The loud cry echoed off the mountains. The raven swooped down before them again, narrowly missing Richard's head. Gaining height, the bird circled. The air whistled through its feathers as it dove at them, driving them back from the water. "Is that bird crazy?" Kaylin asked. "Maybe it's protecting a nest. Or do all ravens behave like that?" Richard had a grip on her arm, ushering her back to the trees. "Ravens are intelligent birds, and they will protect their nest, but they can be odd, too. I fear this one is more than a raven." "More? What do you mean?" The bird settled on a branch and ruffled its glossy black feathers, looking pleased with itself as ravens were wont to do. Richard took his shirt when she held it out. "I'd say it's a chime." Even at the distance, the bird seemed to hear him. It flapped its wings, hopping back and forth on the branch, looking quite agitated. "Remember at the library, the raven outside the window making such a fuss?" "Dear spirit," she breathed in worry. "You think this could be the same one? You think it followed us all this way?" Richard glanced back at her. "What if it's a chime and heard us, and came up here to wait for us?" Kaylin now looked genuinely frightened. What should we do? They reached their horses. Richard yanked his bow off the saddle. He pulled a steel-tipped arrow from the quiver. I think I should kill it. The instant Richard came out from behind the horse, the bird spotted the bow and leaped, almost flinched, into the air with a loud squawk, as if it hadn't expected him to resort to a weapon. When Richard knocked the arrow, the bird took wing, fleeing with frantic calls and screeches. Well, Richard murmured, wasn't that weird? At least we now know it was a chime. The one you shot back at the Mud People's village, the chicken that wasn't a chicken, must have let the other chimes know. Perplexed, Richard shook his head. I guess. Richard, I don't want you swimming that lake. There could be chimes waiting in it. It would be foolish to swim when the chimes are loose. But they seem afraid of me. She put her hand on the side of his neck to keep his gaze. What if they're just lulling you into overconfidence and want to get you out into the middle of deep water? Can you imagine? Zed told us to stay away from water. She rubbed her arms, looking suddenly chilled. Richard, please, let's get out of here. There's something about this place. Richard threw on his shirt and then drew her close. I think you're right. There's no need to push our luck, not after a run-in with that raven that isn't a raven. Besides, Du Chaillu would be so angry we got killed, she'd have her baby before it was time. Kalin clutched his shirt in her fist. She had a suddenly stricken look. Richard, do you think we could... Could what? She released his shirt and patted his chest. Could get out of here. I think we should. They rushed back, both now eager to be away from the lake. He helped her up onto her horse. I think we found what we came for anyway. The rock the Domini Dirch was made from. I think that we need to change our plans. What do you mean? I think we better get back to Fairfield and look through all those books again in the light of what we now know. But what about the vote, the places we've yet to visit? We were going to have to divide up the men anyway and send them out to watch over the voting and counting and then returning the results to Fairfield. We can send them now and have the men speak to the people in each place first. There are men among them I would trust to speak for us. They've heard what we've had to say enough times. We might as well divide them up here and get them on their way while we get back to the estate. Besides, we wouldn't do wrong to see to making sure we convince all the people in Fairfield to vote to join us. Helen nodded. Our first responsibility is the chimes. It won't do us any good to win the vote if the chimes kill everyone. Richard's eye was caught by something. He swung down from his saddle and tossed Kalin the reins to his horse. He crossed the grass back to the clump of spruce. What is it? Kalin called, eager to be off. Richard lifted a drying bough. A saddle. Someone's left their things here and covered them to keep them dry. Probably from that horse we saw, she said. Maybe it belongs to a trapper or something, Richard said. But it looks to have been here for a while. Well, unless you plan on stealing somebody's things, Richard, let's get out of here. When the raven let out a call, Richard hurried back to his horse. It just seemed strange, that's all. As they started down the trail, Richard looked over his shoulder. He saw several ravens circling far up in the sky. He didn't know which one was the raven that wasn't a raven. Maybe they all were. He took his bow from its place on a saddle and hooked it over his shoulder instead. Chapter 57 Dalton gazed out the window of his office as he listened to Stein reporting the number and location of Imperial Order soldiers now stationed as Special Andereth Guard troops inside Andereth. The Domini Dirch were as good as in Jigang's hands. Should Lord Rawl bring his forces, if he even had any close enough, toward Andereth, he would quickly be a leader without an army to lead. The Emperor also sent word that he wishes me to personally express, on his behalf, his appreciation for the efficient cooperation he has been receiving. From my men's reports, the minister looks to have done a remarkable job of taking the teeth out of the Andereth army. They will present even less of an obstacle than we thought. Dalton looked back over his shoulder, but saw no smirk on the man's face. He put his boots up on Dalton's desk and leaned back in his chair to clean his fingernails with a dagger. Stein looked contented. Dalton reached over and picked up the useless but valuable little book the woman had brought up from the library. the book once belonging to Joseph Ander. He set it on the other side of his desk so Stein's boots wouldn't damage it. From what Teresa reported to him, Dalton thought Stein should have every reason to be contented, what with the number of women living their daydreams by tattling to eager ears the raw excitement they had found in the bed of the foreign savage. The more outrageously he treated them, the more delighted they were to gossip about it. With the number of women offering themselves willingly, Dalton found it remarkable the man would so frequently still turn his lust on the unwilling. He guessed Stein found the thrill of vanquishing by force more satisfying.
"Yes, the Andereth army looks real pretty, standing there behind the Domini Dirch," Stein grinned. "But their false pride will be of little use to them when they must meet the true face of war."
"We have kept our part of the bargain."
"Believe me, Campbell, I know the worth of you and the minister. Farming may be less glamorous than conquest, but without food, an army grinds to a halt. None of us wishes to take up the pastime of tending the land, but we wish to continue eating. We understand your worth in knowing how to keep the system going. You will be a valuable asset to our cause. And Emperor Jagang wishes me to assure you he looks forward to rewarding such good works once he arrives."
Dalton kept the problems to himself. "When might we expect his arrival?"
"Soon," Stein said, dismissing further detail with a shrug. "But he is concerned about the situation with Lord Rawl. He is leery as to why you would seem to put faith in an outcome so fickle as the voice of the common people."
"I must admit I share his concern." Dalton heaved a sigh. He still wished Bertrand had chosen a less risky road, but as Dalton had come to learn, Bertrand Chanbur relished the risky route, much as Stein preferred unwilling partners. "But, as I've explained," Dalton went on, "by such tactics we will be able to trap Lord Rawl and the Mother Confessor. Without them to lead the enemy forces, the war will quickly fall into a rout, leaving the Midlands a plum for Jagang's picking."
"And so the Emperor is content to let you play this out."
"But there are risks involved."
"Risks. Anything I can do to help."
Dalton took his seat, scooting his chair close to his desk. "I believe we must do more to discredit the cause of Lord Rawl, but in that there is danger. Mother Confessors, after all, have ruled the Midlands for thousands of years. They have not held sway because they have nice smiles. They are women with formidable teeth, as it were. The Lord Rawl, too, is said to be a wizard. We must tread with care, lest we force them into abandoning this vote in favor of action. If that were to happen, we could ruin the plans in which we all have so much invested."
"I told you, we have troops in place. Even if they have an army anywhere close, they can't get it to Andereth, not past the Domini Dirch."
Stein chuckled without humor.
"But I would be happy to have them try."
"As would I. The point is, the Lord Rawl and the Mother Confessor are here, and they are trouble enough."
"I've told you before, Campbell, you shouldn't worry about magic. The Emperor has clipped the claws of magic."
Dalton carefully folded his fingers together before himself on the desk. "You say that often enough, Stein, and as much as I wish to, I find little comfort in mere words. I, too, could promise things, but you expect results that can be seen." Stein waved his knife.
"I have told you before, the Emperor intends to end magic, so men of vision can lead the world into a new era. You will be part of that. Magic's time has passed. It is dying."
"So is the Sovereign, but he's not yet dead." Stein went back to cleaning his nails, paying exaggerated attention to them. He seemed undaunted by Dalton's doubts and went on to try to dispel them.
"You will be pleased to know, then, that unlike your beloved Sovereign, the bearer of magic no longer has fangs. It is toothless. It is no longer a weapon to be feared."
Stein lifted the corner of his cape made of human scalp.
"Those of magic's talents will contribute to my collection. I take the scalps while they are still alive, you know. I enjoy their screams while I'm cutting it off them."
Dalton was unimpressed by the man's boasting and his attempts to shock, but wished he knew what Stein was talking about when he alluded to the end of magic. He knew from Franka's inability to use her gift that something was going on, but he didn't know what, or, more important,
the extent to which it was impaired. He didn't know if Stein was telling the simple truth or an ignorant version of wishful thinking layered over some old-world superstition. Either way, the time had come to act. They could ill afford to let it go on as it was. The measure of how far they dared go in showing their opposition to joining Lord Rawl was the problem Dalton faced. It was necessary to take a stand in order to fire people into saying no to Lord Rawl, but a weak stand was as good as no stand. On the other hand, it was far too dangerous to reach through the bars and twist the nose of the bear if it still had its teeth and claws. Dalton wondered if he might be able to press Stein into being more forthcoming. "It sounds, then, as if we have a serious problem." Stein looked up.
"How so?"
Dalton opened his hands in a gesture of befuddlement. "If magic is no longer a weapon, then the Dominie Dirch, in which we all have invested so much faith, is of no use. And all our plans will fail. I would call that a serious problem." Stein took his feet from Dalton's desk and slid the knife back into its sheath. Putting an elbow on the desk, he leaned forward.
"Not to worry. You see, the thing is, the Emperor still has control of his Sisters of the Dark. Their magic works for him. From what they've told us, something has happened, though. From what I gather, something of magic has gone awry and caused the power of those on Lord Rawl's side to fail. The gang has learned that Lord Rawl no longer has magic backing him. His magic is going to fail. The man is, or soon will be, naked to our blades."
Dalton was now at full attention. If it was true, that would change everything. It would mean he could implement the full extent of his plans at once. It would mean he could take the necessary action and not have to worry over the repercussions or even reprisals from Lord Rawl. Better yet, Lord Rawl and the Mother Confessor would have to place even more of their hope in the vote, while at the same time Dalton, without fear of their actions, ensured their loss. If, that was, it was true about magic failing. Dalton knew one way he might find out. But first, the time had come for Dalton to pay a visit to the ailing sovereign. The time had come to act. He would do it that very night, before the feast planned for the next day. As hungry as she was, Anne was not looking forward to being fed. She had long since been staked to the ground in the grimy tent erected around her, so she knew it was getting to be about that time. At any moment, she expected a burly Imperial Order soldier to storm in with her bread and water. She didn't know what had happened to Sister Alessandra. Anne hadn't seen the woman in well over a week. The soldiers disliked the duty of feeding an old woman. She suspected their comrades made sport of their domestic duty. They would come in, grab her hair in their fist, and push the bread in her mouth, packing it in with stubby, filthy fingers, as if they were stuffing a goose for roasting. As Anne tried to swallow the dry mass before she choked, they would start pouring water down her throat to wash down the bread. It was an unpleasant experience, one over which Anne had no control. As much as she enjoyed food, she was coming to fear it would be the end of her. Once, the soldier who came to feed her had simply thrown the bread on the ground and set a wooden bowl of water beside it, as if she were a dog. He seemed proud of himself in that he had shown her disrespect and saved himself considerable trouble all at the same time. He didn't realize it, but Anne much preferred that method. After he had his laugh and left, she could flop on her side, squirm close, and eat the bread at her own pace, even if she didn't have the luxury of wiping off the dirt. The tent flap opened. A dark shape stepped in, locked out the campfires beyond. Anne wondered what it would be, stuffed goose or dog eating off the ground. To her surprise, it was Sister Alessandra, bringing a bowl giving off the aroma of sausage soup. She even had a candle with her. Sister Alessandra pressed the candle into the dirt to the side. The woman was not smiling. She said nothing. She didn't meet Anne's gaze. In the dim candlelight, Anne could see that Alessandra's face was bruised and scraped. She had a nasty cut on the cheekbone below her left eye, but it looked to be on the mend. The relatively minor wounds seemed to be a variety of ages, from old and near healed to freshly inflicted. Anne didn't have to ask how the woman came to be in such a condition. Her cheeks and both sides of her jaw were red and raw from the stubble of countless unshaven faces.
Alessandra, I am relieved to see you alive. I feared greatly for you.
Alessandra raised one shoulder in a gesture of feigned indifference. She wasted no time in bringing a steaming spoonful of sausage soup to Anne's mouth. Anne swallowed before she had time to savor the taste. Such was her hunger, but just the warm feel of it in her stomach was solid.
I feared greatly for myself, too, Anne said. I dreaded those men were as likely to kill me as get the food stuffed in me.
I know the feeling, Alessandra said under her breath.
Alessandra, are you all right?
Fine. She seemed to have retreated into an emotionless place.
You're not badly injured, then?
I'm better off than some of the others. If we get hurt, a bone broken or something like that, the gang allows us to use our magic to heal one another.
But healing is additive magic.
Sister Alessandra brought the spoon to Anne's mouth. That is why I'm lucky. I have no broken bones like some of the others. We've tried to help them, to heal them, but we were unable to, and so they must suffer. She met Anne's gaze.
A world without magic is a dangerous place.
Anne wanted to remind the woman that she had told her as much, that the chimes were loose, and magic, additive magic anyway, wouldn't work. As Alessandra fed Anne another spoonful, she said,
But I guess you tried to tell me that, prelate.
Anne gave a shrug of her own.
When people tried to convince me the chimes were loose, I at first wouldn't believe them either.
We have that in common. I would say that, as exceptionally stubborn as you are, Sister Alessandra, there is hope you could one day be prelate.
Alessandra, seemingly against her will, smiled with Anne.
Anne watched the spoon with a chunk of sausage linger in the bowl.
Prelate, did you fully expect the Sisters of the Light would believe you that magic had failed, and that they would willingly try to escape with you?
Anne looked up into Alessandra's eyes.
Not fully, no. Although I hoped they would trust my word, having always known me as a woman who values truth, I knew the possibility existed, so great was their fear that, whether they believed me or not, they would refuse to leave. Slaves. Slaves to anything or anyone, despite how much they abhor it, will often cling to that slavery, out of fear the alternative would be insufferable. Look at a drunk, a slave to liquor, who thinks us cruel for trying to get him to abandon his slavery.
And what were you planning in the event the Sisters of the Light refused to abandon their slavery?
Jagang uses them, uses their magic the same as he uses yours. When the chimes are banished, magic will return, and the Sisters will have their power back. Many people will die at their hands, no matter how unwilling are those hands. If they refuse to cast off their slavery and leave with me, they were to be killed.
Sister Alessandra lifted an eyebrow.
My, my, prelate. We are not so different after all. That would have been the reasoning of a Sister of the Dark as well. Just common sense. The lives of a lot of people are at risk.
Anne was famished, and eyed with longing the spoon holding the sausage as it hovered above the nearly full bowl.
So, why were you caught then?
Anne sighed.
Because I didn't think they would lie to me, not about something so important. Though it would be no reason to execute them, it will make the onerous but necessary task a little easier.
Alessandra finally fed Anne the spoonful of sausage. This time Anne made herself chew it slowly so as to enjoy its flavor.
You could still escape with me, Alessandra, Anne said in a quiet tone after she had finally swallowed.
Alessandra picked something from the bowl and cast it aside. She stirred the soup again.
I told you before that would not be possible. Why? Because Jagang told you so. Told you he is still in your mind. That's one reason. Alessandra, Jagang promised you that if you took care of me, he wouldn't send you out to the tents to whore for his men. You told me that was what he said.
The woman paused with a spoon, her eyes brimming with tears.
He belonged to His Excellency.
With her other hand, she touched the gold ring through her bottom lip, the mark of Jagang's slaves.
He can do with us as he wishes.
Alessandra, he lied to you. He said he wouldn't do that if you took care of me. He lied. You can't trust a liar. Not with your future or your life. That was my mistake. But I wouldn't give a liar a second chance at harming me. If he lied about that much of it, how much else is he lying about?
What do you mean?
About how you can never escape because he is still in your mind. He is not, Alessandra. Just as he can't get into my mind, he can't get into yours for now. Once the chimes are banished, yes, but not now. If you swear loyalty to Richard, then you will be protected even after the chimes are banished. You can get away, Alessandra. We could do our grisly duty with the sisters who lied and chose to stay with another liar, and then escape.
Sister Alessandra's voice was emotionless as her face. Prelate, forget I am a sister of the dark, sworn to the Keeper.
In return for what, Alessandra? What has the Keeper of the Underworld offered you? What has he offered that could be better than eternity in the light?
Immortality. Anne sat watching the woman's unflinching gaze. Outside, men, some of whom had abused this helpless 500-year-old sister of the dark, laughed and carried on their nightly amusements. Smells, both fair and foul, drifted in and out of the tent. Sizzling garlic, dung, roasting meat, burning fur, the sweet smell of a birch log in a nearby fire, stale sweat. Anne, too, did not flinch from the gaze.
Alessandra, the Keeper, is lying to you.
Emotion returned to the sister's eyes. She stood and poured the nearly full bowl of soup on the ground outside the tent. Sister Alessandra, 1 foot outside, one inside, turned back.
You can starve, for all I care, old woman. I would rather go back to the tent than listen to your blasphemy.
In her forlorn, solitary silence, in her pain of body and soul, Anne prayed to the Creator, asking that he give Sister Alessandra a chance to return to the light. She prayed, too, for the Sisters of the Light, as lost now as were the Sisters of the Dark. From her place, sitting chained in the dark and lonely tent, it seemed the world had gone mad.
Dear Creator, what have you wrought?
Anne wept.
Is it all lies, too?
Chapter 58. Dalton rushed up to the head table and smiled at Teresa. She looked lonely and forlorn. She did look relieved to see him, though, even though he was late. He saw too little of her lately. There was no helping it. She understood. Dalton kissed her cheek before taking his seat. The minister only acknowledged him with a brief glance. He was busy sharing a lusty look with a woman at a table to the right of the dining hall. It looked as if she could be making suggestive gestures with a piece of rolled beef. The minister was smiling. Rather than being repelled by Bertrand's sexual indulgences, many more women were actually attracted to him because of it, even if they had no intention of acting on that attraction. It seemed to be a quirk of the female mind that some women were irresistibly drawn to tangible evidence of sexual virility, regardless of its impropriety. It was a visceral whiff of danger, something tantalizing, forbidden. The more some men behaved the rogue, the heavier many women panted.
I hope you've not been too bored, Dalton whispered to Teresa,
pausing momentarily to appreciate the glow of her faithful affection. Other than his brief smile to Teresa, he was doing his best to maintain his customary placid face when the fruition of all his work was at hand. He took a long draught of wine, not tasting it, but impatient for its effect to settle in.
I've missed you, that's all. Bertrand has been telling jokes.
Teresa blushed.
But I can't repeat them, not here anyway.
Her smile, her mischievous smile, stole onto her face.
Maybe when we get home, I'll tell you.
He mimed a smile, his mind already racing forward to weighty matters.
If I get in early enough, I have to get a new batch of messages out yet tonight.
Something, he forced himself to stop drumming his fingers on the table. Something important, momentous, has happened.
Tantalized, Teresa leaned forward.
What?
Your hair is growing out well, Tess.
It was as long as her present station allowed it. He couldn't keep himself from hinting.
but I do believe it may have considerably longer to grow.
Dalton.
Her eyes were widening as she considered what could possibly be his meaning, but confusion visited her face too, for she was unable to imagine how the fulfillment of his long-held ambition was possible, given present circumstances.
Dalton, has this anything to do with what you have always told me?
Her sober expression took the rest of her words.
I'm sorry, darling. I shouldn't get ahead of myself. I may be reading too much into it anyway. Be patient. You will hear in a few minutes.
Best if news such as this come from the minister. Lady Chanbor glanced briefly to the woman with the rolled meat. The woman, as if doing nothing more than minding her table companions, pulled her curls across her face as she returned her gaze to them. Hildemara gave Bertrand a brief, private, murderous glare before leaning past him toward Dalton.